Imam Ali Rashid from Masjid Malcolm Shabazz. The Muslim mosque is named after the late and honorable Imam Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz, known commonly as Malcolm X.
I've always had the name Malik El-Shabazz, only I only used it in the Muslim world. Well, Hajj is a title that is given to any Muslim who makes the pilgrimage to Mecca during the official Hajj season.
Will you now use Shabazz and drop X?
I'll probably continue to use Malcolm X as long as the situation that produced it exists.
You don't feel that Shabazz takes the place of X?
My going to Mecca and going into the Muslim world, into the African world, and being recognized and accepted as a Muslim and as a brother may solve the problem for me personally. But I personally feel that my personal problem is never solved as long as the problem is not solved for all of our people in this country. So I remain Malcolm X as long as there is a need to protest and struggle and fight against the injustices that our people are involved in this country.
His emphasis was that if there was any good in anybody, it is time to display it now. If we're talking about actions based on religious doctrine. And consequently, that attracted me to the individual. He was very studious. He was a person who had a magnetic personality, always with a broad smile. But when he spoke with fervor. He spoke with fire in his tone. He had, in other words, that intensity for his people to be recognized first among themselves as equal to any man, and then to make others recognize our contribution to humanity was essential.
Malcolm X inherited some of this consciousness from his father, who was a Baptist minister and organizer for Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. It was an obvious influence on the young Malcolm X that was later translated into his speeches before audiences around the country.
What makes the so-called Negro unable to stand on his own two feet? He has no self-confidence. He has no proud confidence in his own race. Because the white man destroyed your and my past, destroyed our knowledge of our culture. And by having destroyed it, now we don't know we have any achievement, any accomplishment. And as long as you can be convinced that you never did anything, you can never do anything. This is why the white man, his little children, he tells them about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, all these white heroes. But we are never taught about any black hero. Only someone we're shown in history is my grandfather was picking cotton. Cotton picking don't move me. No. But when it comes to teaching the black people something about great black men who stood their ground, who were scientists, who were civilizers, who were fathers of culture and civilization, the white man has shrewdly written that role out of the textbook. And today, the effect that it has on you and me, we don't think we can stand on our own two feet.
I'm Ray Alexander Minter, and I had lunch and met with Malcolm X in, I guess the year was 1960, 59 or 60, in Boston. I was a promotion manager of Beacon Press, and a book on the black Muslims called The Black Muslims in America was to be published that April. No one knew much about the Muslims, and no one really understood the importance of Malcolm at that time. But I remember him telling me that the white man was going to get me. I remember that distinctly. And I had lived more or less in integrated settings. I had come from a civil rights family, so I knew what it was to be black in America. I thought I understood it. And this older man was telling me something about the ominousness of something was going to happen on the horizon to me. And I was wondering if he was talking about the success of the book or my job or what. In any event, I didn't think much more about it.
Don't let the white man fool you. Don't let the white man smile at you and lull you to sleep. Behind that smile is a vicious heart. Behind those teeth is an animal-like beast who doesn't have it within him to want for you what he wants for himself and his own kind.
Don't let that man fool you.
Now, I'm not a revisionist. I will not tell you that when Malcolm spoke, we all said, oh, golly, by gee, by gee, by gee. Isn't he great? When Malcolm spoke, I, like everybody else, ducked.
Poet Sonia Sanchez.
Because his words were hardly hard, you know what I'm saying? And we ducked. I belonged to something called New York Core at the time. We thought we were the baddest thing going on the planet Earth in New York City, you know what I'm saying? Finally, Malcolm said out loud, you cannot have an event unless I'm allowed to speak because I am Harlem. So we said, oh, isn't that terrible? And what we did simply is that every time he came to do something, like, you know, we'd leave. And Malcolm came and everybody went back to the office on 125th Street. And it was one of those cloudy days, you know. You know when it's cloudy in New York City, you can see the yellows and reds on the apartment buildings? You know, because otherwise you can't see it. Otherwise it's some murky kind of color. But when it's cloudy, you can actually see the reds and yellows on the buildings, you know. And I looked up and saw the reds and yellows on Malcolm, and he started to talk, and I was standing on the aisle and just looking. And you know how sometimes when the sun's coming in, you rush to pull the shade down, but before you pull the shade down, some sun has come in. So I went back to New York court office, and you know Malcolm said, da, da, da. And they said, girl, don't you know he's a racist? I said, oh, yeah, that's right, he is. Yeah, right. Went to a party that weekend that we all had, I said, Malcolm said, they said, girl, what's wrong with you? Don't you realize that, you know, we don't talk about this Malcolm? And I said, yeah, I went home and told my father about Malcolm. He said, we don't listen to Malcolm at all. That's a terrible man. And I woke up and found myself alone with the rise and wind of history. Alone, because everybody cut me off because I started to talk about Malcolm. Well, other people did, too. A lot of intellectuals and a lot of writers and a lot of musicians, a lot of teachers began to talk about this Malcolm also. And I guess many of us were blessed to have met Malcolm.
Malcolm X was a firm believer in black self-reliance and responsibility, a theme that echoed through many of his speeches to the black community.
Get off the welfare. Get out of that compensation line. Be a man. Earn what you need for your own family. Then your family respects you. They are proud to say, that's my father. She's proud to say, that's my husband. Father means you're taking care of those children. Right. Just because you made them, that don't mean you're a father. Anybody can make a baby. Right. But anybody can't take care of them. Right. Anybody can go and get a woman. Yeah. But anybody can't take care of a woman. Right. So husband means you are taking care of your wife. Right. Father means you are taking care of your children. Right. You are accepting the responsibilities of manhood.
I'm Gardner Taylor. I'm now pastor emeritus of the Concord Baptist Church here in Brooklyn. I do remember conversation with him, I guess, began in 1960-61 when there was a protest about discrimination in the building trades, particularly sheet metal workers, centered at Downstate Medical Center. Every day, Malcolm would move up and down across the street from where the demonstrations were going on. One day he said to me that he wanted to remind the society and the authorities that there was another path other than the one we were trying to pursue, which was, I suppose, nonviolent demonstrations. And he presented, I guess, what I'd have to call, he sought to present and succeeded, an ominous alternative to what we were trying to do. And I think that may well have characterized Malcolm's career.
Malcolm X's relationship with the civil rights movement was, for the most part, strained. The Reverend Charles Kenyatta, formerly Charles 37X, was a close associate and bodyguard. He recalls how Malcolm X often considered challenging the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr.
A lot of brothers and sisters today don't understand that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X was two of the greatest orators of that particular period of history. And Malcolm used to always use the term, how if he ever came close to Dr. Martin Luther King, he was going to slap him to see how nonviolent he were. But he got a lot of laugh behind that. And then I recall that Malcolm used to always use the terminology, how I'm working hard to get the brothers and sisters up off of their knees. He's trying to put them on their knees.
And who's this other person you mentioned? Dr. Martin Luther King? Well, anybody who teaches black people to turn the other cheek, who robs the black man of his right to defend himself, is not a leader or a spokesman for black people. And it's wrong to teach the black man to turn his cheek until someone gets around here and teaches white people to turn their cheek. If the black man must suffer peacefully in the face of brutality, then the white man should learn how to suffer peacefully in the face of brutality, which we don't see any evidence that he has learned to do this.
I say sometimes about Malcolm, after having worked pretty directly with him for 2 years, that he was the most electrical personality I ever met.
Author Alex Haley assisted Malcolm X in the writing of the book The Autobiography of Malcolm X, now considered a classic African-American history text.
I never knew anyone who, in my whole life, I've never met anyone who was more driven, more, if it even be, obsessed with that which he stood for. In his life, he kind of almost went full circle. And at every phase of it, he went with all his heart. He worked at whatever he was with as long as he could stay awake. He literally did. I would absolutely use the word obsessed. Mm-hmm.
Close friend and confidant of Malcolm X and his family, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Percy Sutton.
Percy Sutton was Malcolm X's lawyer. Sutton recalls that Malcolm's endorsement of his political campaign in 1964 was highly unusual for the black nationalist leader.
I used to be in politics. And I liked it. But for 11 consecutive years in Harlem, I ran for some political office year in and year out. And I promise the electorate that if you elect me, I'll change everything. And I really believed it. But for 11 consecutive years, the people of Harlem, in their good judgment, rejected me year after year after year. Until finally, in 1964, a man called Malcolm X, who had not been involved in the electoral politics of the open society, decided to support me in my race for the assembly. And the record will show that with Malcolm X's support, I became the assemblyman from Central Harlem, City of New York. But I would share with you the fact that I asked Minister Malcolm, asked him, would he go with me to Albany as I was sworn in. Now, I knew the consequences of his going. I knew the sense of intimidation that would fall upon the state Senate and the state assembly as I walked in with this man that they really didn't know. This man who was not violent, as they suggested. The only violence he was ever involved in was the violence of his own death. We walked into the chambers in Albany, New York, and there was silence. And then a magical thing occurred. Here were all these right-wing people who did not boo, who did not shout, but came to ask the autograph of Malcolm X.
Well, I'm John Henry Clark. I'm Professor Emeritus of African World History at the Department of Africana Studies at Hunter College. Malcolm established something which very few people know about, which was very effective. A shadow cabinet, a group of non-Muslims different specialties who gave him information. Anytime he wanted background information on certain aspects of history, he would turn to me and I would give him a folder. Most people who say they taught Malcolm X are lying, because no one taught Malcolm X. He was one of the fastest learners I've ever met in my life. All you did was to place information at his disposal, and he went over that information and made out of it whatever he thought was needed. I gave him a folder one evening. I handed it to his representative at 7. He said he didn't get to see it until 9. At 11 o'clock, he was debating 3 college professors, and he made them look like children.
We have to have the type of understanding of Africa and the type of understanding of our people here in order to build a line of communication between the two. And once the lines of communication have been established and our African brothers can stretch forth their hands and reach us, and we can stretch forth our hands and reach them, why, there's nothing that this blue-eyed man in this country will be able to do to you and me successfully from that day onward.
On June 28, 1964, in New York City, Malcolm X announced the formation of the OAAU, the Organization of African American Unity.
The Organization of Afro-American Unity, number one, has proposed a unified effort on the part of all Afro-American leaders and Afro-American organizations in a common struggle to unite together and try and lift the American Negro's fight for freedom from the level of civil rights to the level of human rights. And then it's our intention to take it at this level into the United Nations and charge the United States government with the violation of our human rights in the same manner that the South African government is charged with violating the human rights of the Africans in South Africa, and the government of Portugal is charged with the violation of human rights of the Africans in Angola and in Mozambique and other places. We intend to internationalize the plight of the 22 million Afro-Americans who reside here in the United States.
Oh, sure. I knew of Malcolm, and we would try to go and hear Malcolm, and, you know, we'd look at Malcolm all the time on TV and anywhere else that we could. I mean, I was a follower of Malcolm by that time.
Poet Amiri Baraka.
I met Malcolm X in, I mean, met him to really to talk to in 1965. I think it was January, the month before he died, along with Mohammed Babu, who they had, as I remember, just recently overthrown the government of Zanzibar, and they were putting together a new country called Tanzania from Tanganyika and Zanzibar. And that's Malcolm and Babu and I met in a hotel room, and we talked all night. And essentially it was about, you know, the movement, what was happening, particularly what was happening since he was no longer hooked up with the Nation of Islam, the need for people in these various organizations, to have people in various organizations and to get various organizations involved collectively in the struggle, no matter if our organization certainly couldn't agree down the line ideologically, you know, what kind of commonality and what kind of united front could be put together. And that was very striking to me, because when I saw King had was growing a beard, didn't have on any tie. That was during the Poor People's Campaign. And that's the very same thing he was talking about, United Front. So that's always been sort of, you know, indelibly etched into my mind, the idea that both of these men died as just after they were sounding this note of a United Front politics.
No Negro leaders have fought for civil rights. They have begged the white man for civil rights. They have begged the white man for freedom. And anytime you beg another man to set you free, you will never be free. Freedom is something that you have to do for yourselves. And until the American Negro lets the white man know that we are really, really ready and willing to pay the price that is necessary for freedom, our people will always be walking around here second-class citizens, or what you call 20th century slaves.
What price are you talking about, sir?
The price of freedom is death.
Malcolm X was assassinated on February 21, 1965, at the Audubon Ballroom in New York as he prepared to give a speech. Charles 37X, now the Reverend Charles Kenyatta, remembers.
Well, the night at the Audubon Ballroom, that particular night, and this is where that Malcolm told me that I had, we was coming across the bridge, and there was those in the group who told Malcolm that 37 has lost his mind. Because if Malcolm had listened to me, this is just my belief, he would have still been alive. But they had wore him down. He had gotten to the place that he wanted to die.
And normally I attended the lectures at the ballroom. I would have been there.
Dr. John Henry Clark.
I was in Norfolk, Connecticut, on a lecture, and right in the home of the host, they announced that Malcolm X had been assassinated. Then I began to, first place I was so shattered, and I was almost nervous to the point of being immobile. I just excused myself and went to the bathroom and closed the door and cried like a child.
When Malcolm X was assassinated, I was in California. And certainly I was very shocked to have heard that, as we all were.
Imam Ali Rashid.
Those persons that were implicated, some of them have already done 25 years in the penitentiary. And we know that assassinations are not out of the realm of America or anyone else when they want to eliminate someone from power.
Hey, Malcolm X was shot. I was downtown in a bookstore at a book party for somebody.
Amiri Baraka.
And as a matter of fact, a guy named Leroy McLucas, a friend of mine, came in, a photographer, came in and said, Malcolm got shot. And that was actually not only for me the end of that book party, but I think for all intents and purposes, it was the end of the whole, you know, phase of my life. Because I thought in my mind that that was a full open declaration of war. I mean, I fully thought at that time that it was definite, that people, they meant that it was going to be war, that we were going out into the streets, that this was ready. Because I thought that the only way they would kill Malcolm is that they, you know, it was an onslaught of the worst kind. And so certainly at that point, my mind became much more geared to a war mentality, you know. Oh, yeah.
Malcolm beats in us like the heart he gave us. He makes us stand up straight like the courage he left us. In that last gesture of will, brothers and sisters, he said to unleash the bullet shower, and he was dead to kill us. And we are dead till he lives. Malcolm is in us now. He left the outside to live on the inside. He speaks to me often. He speaks to us all. Self-determination, he says. Self-respect, he cries. Self-defense, he calls, and we are not with him. And our enemies kill him. We must be Malcolm, all, Malcolm, bone and brain, because he is in us now, like our memory of death, like our will to be ourselves, like our future of freedom. Malcolm speaks through us now. He is that self-determining idea that will never die. If we live, so will Malcolm. So we call him and he speaks to us. He is the angry sky, the burning wind, the quiet, knowledgeable rain upon our slave-hurt lives. We call Malcolm's name to remember ourselves, to be what we must be, if we will be, if we will, if we will. Malcolm!
No sellout.
Thank you.
Malcolm X.
No sellout.
You can't deny that. You may not like my saying it, but you can't deny it.
You can't say that.